Good Monday morning. It is Monday, the 29th of April. Hope everyone had a lovely weekend. I'm here with Ray Graff, WAMC's newsman at large. Good morning. How are you, sir?
Is he calling me large? Hello.
No, under a different administration. No. Also joining us this morning for our first half hour is College of St. Rose Communications Professor Paul Conti is with us. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, gentlemen.
It is great to have you here.
Thank you for the invite.
It is it's a delight to have you. Coming up at the after the NPR news break at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined by EPA Regional Administrator Judith Henk.
Excellent. Now, can I ask you never to bring a news director in the studio while I'm reading a newscast? It puts me under a lot of pressure, and it's not a good way to start the week.
Well, here's the deal. You know, Paul Conti, for those of you who don't know, is a longtime news director for WNYT, News Channel 13, and is now a professor of communications at the College of St. Rose. And we brought Paul in today to talk a lot about social media, talk about news, and what kind of resources this has become for journalists and newsrooms. And it's a fascinating topic. It's one we've been sort of dealing with over the last couple of weeks and months. And I know something that you've been doing a lot of research on. We're in a brave new world, I guess.
Yes. Everybody's inviting. In fact, I'm staring at a little note here in front of me that invites people to comment on a program so that you can read it. I'm not sure I know what the value of that is, but we're always inviting people to do that.
So, let me answer the question.
Okay.
Which is, for us, we think, well, A, that's outreach. B, it is a way to bring people into the conversation so that they have a say.
Yeah.
And also to kind of give us a barometer of where people are and what they're thinking on a particular issue. Do I find it overly surprising? No. Do we learn from it occasionally? Do we act as a result of it? Yeah, I would say sometimes.
Yeah, and you would have a better demographic profile to support that expectation too. You have a more educated, more affluent audience listening. So the comments you would typically get from your audience would be probably more informed, but largely the comments that I see in social media that are invited, a large number of them fall into, well, the category of sort of valueless. I don't know what they add to the discussion. Nobody has any barometer to tell how many people are sock puppeting.
Right.
Now, give us a definition of what you mean by sock puppeting.
People who have multiple accounts under, you know, one identity, multiple accounts to have phantom conversations in support of an idea, but it's actually just one person with 20 of the same comments. Mm. And nobody's doing any verification on that. And, you know, with letters, it's a little easier. And, you know, when newspapers publish letters to the editors, they call the person. But there is no arbitration other than weeding out profanity or racism on what gets posted on social media sites.
Do you think there should be?
Yeah, I do. I think it should be subjected to the same type of scrutiny that any other news comment would be subject to, either whether in print or broadcast.
Why do you think, well, I know the answer to this, I think I know the answer to this, which is, why do you believe that with Facebook comments and especially Twitter, that, and I'm going to point a finger at the 24-hour news stations, but not exclusively, because they did it during the Olympic coverage on NBC. They do it on the Today Show. They do it on Good Morning America, where they will take tweets and use them as content.
Yep.
They will use them as what used to be, quote, the man on the street, and they will get reaction from people. And I ask you why they do that. To me, it's a form of laziness, but I don't know if that's an overstatement or if there's really value there, if we keep in mind what you said at the very beginning.
I think some of it has to do with just pure promotion. They're using social media to promote back to their main media site or their main media outlet, whatever that might be. Frequently, you see the identities of reporters from various newspapers or television or radio stations, although very few radio stations other than this one and WGY actually have news product on a regular basis. But they have accounts and they post links to their own stories.
Yeah.
And that's to get so by inviting people to comment, by inviting people to engage Facebook or Twitter or any of the other social media outlets, they might come into contact with some of those links more often, and therefore it builds promotion. So I think they're actually building an audience on social media streams.
So, and what does that mean for us as a viewer and as an audience and what we learn? And I ask the question with two examples. One being the comments from the general public, whoever that may be, but also the comments from people who are, quote unquote, on the scene or at the event, who are providing a bird's eye view, maybe, maybe not. Again, it's not verified. We don't know. Are they in Boston? Were they at the finish line of the Boston Marathon? They say they are. We are reporting it as this person has tweeted. What do we gain from that?
Well, in the case of exposure to links to take people back, I don't think there's a lot of harm in that. I think, you know, it's promotion.
Right.
That's always existed. Marketing your news product is something everybody does, and I don't have a problem with that. I do have a problem, though, when news organizations start to rely on people who are passing along information via social media streams without verification, and we've seen a lot of that going on over the past 2-3 years.
Well, I mean, we have seen in our newsroom the situation where it can be beneficial on in the back office. In other words, not on the air. But you may get something, and we have in this last Boston Marathon situation, where, well, okay, let's verify this. But throwing it directly on a crawl on the TV, I think, is a sketchy proposition.
Somebody could tweet to us that we know and say, my son is in Boston. And then you think, okay, well, that would be somebody that we could talk to. But we're not going to report that until we actually talk to the person, make sure that that's where they are, and talk to them on the phone. So
Not that I'm the arbitrator of any of this.
But today you are.
Today I am. I don't have a
and
problem.
And we believe you should be, in general.
I don't have a problem with news organizations using it as a tip.
Yeah.
Anything that's
absolutely
that sends you off in a direction is a valuable lead. But all too often we've got egregious examples of people where stuff that was learned through social media got put right into scripts and used. I mean, I passed along some examples early this morning going back to Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah.
You had a hedge fund manager who somehow became a reliable source during Sandy, and he was tweeting out, well, inaccuracies. Mm. Nothing that was tweeted out by that gentleman turned out to be true, but it got put directly onto air.
Now, is this, and we've talked about this post-Boston Marathon and even before, is this now just a question of this voracious 24-hour news cycle needing some edge all the time? In other words, it seems to get worse with every big event. We had Newtown, and you saw so much social media directly on there 10 years ago, and 9/11, not so much. But it seems to be getting more and more that the 24-hour news cycle on so many different outlets are just sucking in whatever they can, true or not. And can this end? Can people rein it in?
I think they can, but somebody has to take initiative. And I think, you know, like most things, it's not one thing that's going to solve the problem. There's going to have to be sort of a multifaceted approach to it. I think some of it actually is our responsibility at the college level. We have to instill in future journalists that this is a resource, but it is not a source. The same rules that we apply to sourcing stories, whatever those rules might be for an organization, have to apply to using this material. It has to be verified. It can't simply be used because there's a 24-hour clock on you that demands that it be fed. You have to verify what it is. Today, if you go to certain websites around the country, there are still pictures that show sharks in the water swimming around that have been photoshopped in, claiming that these sharks were swimming around in people's yards in New Jersey during Hurricane Sandy. They have not been removed from legitimate news organization sites.
legitimate news organizations.
Yeah.
And that's the scary
most
part.
Most local television. I should separate. I don't want to imply that NBC or ABC or CBS has any of that up there or any of the other large
network affiliates.
But they're network affiliates. Yeah.
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 Let me ask you about one of the things, and I used the word laziness before, and what I was asking about really is something that you brought out. And some of the points that you sent me earlier, which I think is fascinating in the sense that you look in the Boston bombing case, that we as journalists would never say, I would be uncomfortable. I think we are taught in journalism school, don't do this, don't assume, don't speculate. However, they're using Twitter, they're allowing and Facebook, they're allowing their readers and their listeners to speculate on the accused, who that is,
right,
what their motivations are,
right,
and letting them, if you will, do the dirty work.
Yep.
And then reporting that. But isn't that the same if John King is saying it?
Yes. And I'm not sure always. I mean, there were some people speculating.
Maybe John King was a bad example given his, we had some, faux pas. But
we did have some people over the weekend speculating on some of the national talk shows that the bombers may have been helped. And they don't have any evidence. It just, and I don't know whether they have or haven't been. There's an investigation taking place, and eventually we'll learn that. I'm not always sure it's wise to speculate that, but I get what they're doing. Nonetheless, it tends to feed into a conspiracy theory kind of thing, and then that'll get pushed along in social media. To this day, you can find people who are convinced the U.S. government is responsible for the attacks on itself from September 11th.
And we hear from them often on Vox Pop and otherwise.
Absolutely. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation with College of St. Rose communications professor and former news director Paul Conte. We're talking about social media and news coverage. We love your input as well. You can email us at roundtable@wamc.org, and then we will vet it, and then a couple of weeks we'll get it on
you.
The air.
There'll be some source checking, and you may get on, you may not.
You're listening to the Roundtable at WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Lake George Kayak Company, a kayak, canoe, and stand-up paddleboard center providing sales, rentals, and lessons, lakegeorgekayak.com. And the Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole-grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com.
Fellas good for the moolah.
Paul Conte joins us. Ray Graff is here. It's our roundtable panel. And again, we invite you and your comments, roundtable@wamc.org, as well as the Facebook and Twitter options that are available to you as well. You're now teaching, and you talk about the responsibility at the college level.
Yep.
But you came from a very active newsroom, a well-respected newsroom, where you were news director. And so if you were at the helm now, what policies would you want to see in place? What would you expect of your reporters, and what would you insist on?
I'm going to write this down.
Well, two things. And you'd have to have a policy.
Right.
That was written out. And I would apply the two sourcing rule to that. I mean, you can't just use it. You have to find two credible, legitimate sources that will verify the tip.
From a different source? In other words, if you get something
sources
on Twitter, you got to go someplace else other than Twitter?
A famous example of that being violated was back when Gabby Giffords was shot. Somebody thought they had two sources, but they were two sources within the coroner's office. Yeah. So they hear the same rumor being passed along. Actually, it wasn't the coroner's office. It was the sheriff's department.
Right.
I start a new rumor.
Yeah.
It was the sheriff's department, and one sheriff's deputy says to another, and the next thing you know, it's everybody in the sheriff's department believes it, but they needed to have somebody in the sheriff's department and maybe the medical examiner's office to verify that.
Well, in other words, if you had a tip, say, on Twitter, you knew it was a valid Twitter account,
right,
would you have to go to something other than Twitter from another valid account?
Well, I'd say based on what happened to AP, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, AP got hacked. Yeah. AP sent out a message. AP didn't send it out, but the hacker sent out a message that the president had been hurt in a bombing.
Yeah.
Completely untrue. Somebody was vandalizing the AP account. I don't know that at today's level of security that we can accept even a verified account as being accurate. I think you really need to talk to somebody to know. You have to get a hold of somebody at the White House press office or somebody from Homeland Security and something.
So how do you stop this before the stock market crashes?
Well, you know, going back, having the policy in and of itself isn't going to do it all. You also have to let the people that work for you know that the policy exists. And I think that when the conversations I've had with people around the country, a substantial number of them actually do have policies in place. But where there's a weakness is when you bring a new employee in, there's so many things that you're trying to get accomplished in that first week with a new employee that how much time gets spent on that issue. I mean, everybody's got to watch the tapes. Everybody's got to do that paperwork. And there's so much going on. There's so much activity.
Right.
The new employee has to legitimately find out where everything is in the building. And then when are we getting to, well, here's what's good reporting for this organization. But I would insist that you have to have two sources and that somebody has to verify them. And I would prefer that they be two different people in the newsroom doing it.
Would you look at a one of the things that I saw during the Boston event of the bombing, that you would see there was a CNN feed, Twitter feed, and CNN would come
getting
out.
Getting the chills. Here.
Yeah, and CNN would come out with stuff.
Yeah.
But then the individual reporters, so like Susan Candiotti would have a feed.
Yeah.
And now we know Susan Candiotti is a reporter for CNN.
Yeah.
So even if CNN says, well, they're not reporting this, but Susan Candiotti is saying, I've just learned this, and maybe she's, you know, waving, trying to get attention to get on the air. And meanwhile, she tweets this out to everybody and says, okay, this is it. It hasn't even been verified by her own newsroom. They're not willing to put it on the air, but she's going to put it out to the people who follow her.
Right. Those are unverified. There's no arbitration in that. There's no editor looking at it. There's nobody.
But that can only hurt CNN, not to mention Susan Candiotti.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, I think those are bad ideas. I think if you're doing that to represent the brand and the image and the news credibility of the news organization, somebody's got to be looking over their shoulder. I mean, the whole purpose of having editors and producers and people to look at scripts and copy was so that there is no rush to air. It's better to get it right than to get it wrong. I mean, there were some magnificent reporting during the Boston bombing. The Boston Globe did some terrific reporting. Pete Williams from NBC did some absolutely
excellent,
fabulous reporting. So there was some really good reporting that took place. There was some really bad reporting, too.
I think one of the things that I can't believe that we're in the situation, but from my understanding, and maybe the jury's still out, I don't know, but there were, I mean, massive mistakes made on cable television, massive mistakes in the case of the New York Post made in print. To my knowledge, those journalists have not been let go or reprimanded or action taken. I have to ask you this question. You were a news director in an affiliate, an NBC affiliate, for a long time. You got a young kid. It's his first newscast. It's a Saturday evening. The microphone is open.
Oh, no.
He says bad words. Do you fire him?
yeah, probably. Yeah.
So he gets fired because he doesn't know he's on the air. Now, I understand. But then there's other people here that are doing things that are just horrible.
The problem for me isn't that he didn't know that the red light was on. I understand there's no floor director there.
Yep.
For people that don't know what that is, it's a person standing and pointing to you to tell
telling
you
you're on. He doesn't have an earpiece.
Floor director anymore?
It's robots. It's robots. Oh. It's robots. iRobot. There's nobody on the floor.
That's no good.
They just know that they're on the air when they see the red light go on or somebody says something, and he didn't have an earpiece. So he didn't know he was on the air. His co-anchor knew she was on the air, but he didn't know he was on the air. I guess he was upset because he was pre-reading copy and he didn't know how to pronounce names. But what you teach young people is when you're wearing a microphone, Don't say anything you don't want people to know.
Right, and you should teach that to politicians as well.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah, the former vice president. Yeah.
But what I'm saying is you slip up and you say, oh, okay, that's bad.
Yeah.
And, you know, you said a word that Big Poppy said in front of the entire world on network television at Fenway Park. Boom, you know, you're okay. You can stay. That's fine. But then there's this horrible reporting. I mean, I know this is a bit of an apples and oranges comparison. I just don't understand how people get away with that of things that are egregious, things that are bad reporting, that are sloppy and are not the responsibility is not taken care of. Why is the same concern about the brand that you have over somebody saying or slipping up in the product that you're delivering to the people at home?
Well, I think there should be. And, you know, there's obviously degrees. There's a difference between saying something that's profane and something that's, you know, profane. So there might be a degree of words, but there's also a degree in mistakes. Misspelling somebody's name might not get you fired, but declaring somebody famous dead that wasn't dead probably should.
Yeah.
That's bad.
Yeah.
We are going to, we want to thank you very much for being with us and giving us a lot to think about. And
Thanks again for the invite.
I'm sure Alan is out. He'll be back tomorrow. But, you know, in a couple of days, you can come back and we can do this again. When Alan's around, I'm sure he'll have a lot to say.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. That'll be fun to listen to.
Paul Conte, thank you very much for being
with
us. I appreciate it. We're going to take a quick underwriting break and find out what's coming up on Midday Magazine. And when we return, we'll talk to EPA Regional Administrator Judith Enk. You're listening to the Roundtable Panel on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Mount St. Mary College, Newburgh, offering bachelor's and master's degrees in business, education, and nursing. Transfer admissions event for college-age students and adults with college credits May 22nd. MSMC.edu. And Little Wolf Architecture, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, providing collaborative discovery and design for dwellings in the regional landscape, featuring passive house and natural home strategies. LittleWolfArch.com.
I'm Jay Allison, and we're back with a new season of the Moth Radio Hour, True Stories Told Live, by a boxing champion, a flight attendant, a preacher, an atheist, and lots of others, telling stories about narrow escapes, profound love, harrowing journeys, dreams come true, and much more, as if that weren't enough. That's the Moth Radio Hour from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
You can hear The Moth Fridays at 1 p.m. right here on WAMC.
This is Capital Region Bureau Chief Dave Lucas today on Midday Magazine, a cheating scandal at the University at Albany. Reports indicate an undetermined number of students may be paying others to complete homework and other assignments. What could be driving them to do this? Will it affect the college's reputation? Can anything be done to stop it? I'll speak with students and educators today at noon on Midday Magazine with Brian Shields here on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Spot Coffee, Saratoga Springs, New York, a community-oriented cafe featuring fresh roasted coffee, baked goods, soups, salads, pizza, and more. SpotCoffee.com. And Capitol Rep presenting John Logan's Broadway play Red about artist Mike Rothko, now through May 19th, CapitolRep.org.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel. WAMC's Ray Graff is with me this morning, and we have quite a nice panel this morning.
Lovely.
This is very nice. We have with us now EPA Regional Administrator Judith Enk joins us. Judith is a longtime friend, and we have, I think one of the first people I interviewed when I came here 20 years ago was Judith when she was at NYPIRG. And look at her now.
She must have been a child.
Yes. Well,
a
you know,
toddler.
She went from NYPIRG to the, you know, like, the head of the EPA,
yeah,
and I'm still here.
So well, that you know, you've risen to your max level, and she's still on the uptick.
And we both graduated from the same institution at the College of St. Rose. So it shows what, you know, willpower can do for you.
Yeah.
It's a delight to see you. We love having you here.
Wonderful to be at AMC.
You are in town to kick off the fourth season of dredging of the Hudson River, of the Upper Hudson River. You are going to be in Fort Edward later today to announce the start of this. And I'm a Washington County resident. I spent a lot of time traveling up and down Route 4. And I'm curious as to your perspective on how this is going.
Well, I think it's going remarkably well. A lot of the scare tactics that were used over the decades about PCBs being resuspended in the river and becoming a problem simply has not proven to be the case. So baseball fans look forward to the first day of the season. I look forward to the first day of PCB dredging. This is my sort of first day of baseball experience.
Oh, you.
So I know, I'm such a policy dork. So today, actually, this very day will be the first day that we're getting back in the river. This is season number 4. If all goes well, we will exceed the halfway point of dredging. So not only has the environmental problems that were feared by some not been realized, but we are ahead of schedule. And in the process, illustrating that environmental cleanups create jobs, 350 new jobs have been created in upstate New York due to this project.
Technologically speaking, have you learned things that you're doing differently now from the first year or two the dredging started?
Yes. It gets better every year. The first year, there was far too much capping of the sediment, so we were able to do a very careful analysis on how to limit capping. And there is now
what is capping?
I'm sorry. Instead of picking up the contaminated mud at the bottom of the Hudson, in some Superfund cleanups, you just bring in clean dirt and gravel and cap the hot spots. We did not want to do a capping remedy here. We thought we needed to literally dig in with a clamshell, take the PCBs out of the bottom of the river and send it to a commercial hazardous waste disposal facility. So year one, there was too much capping. And there was some odor problems, noise problems. Mm-hmm. That has all been addressed. And I think year two was substantially better than year one.
Good.
It's fascinating to me watching it because it doesn't seem, I mean, I'm not a scientist. I don't know what's going on. You just see this big thing go into the water, grab all of this stuff, bring it up onto a barge, and then it's taken care of. And you think to yourself, well, how, given that it's underwater, given that things move, given that all of, you know, it's a flowing body of water, of how does that become complete? It seems almost impossible to be able to know what you have at any given time.
Well, a lot happens before the clamshell goes into the bottom of the river. There are literally tens of thousands of samples taken, and we identify the hot spots. So we're not doing shore-to-shore dredging. We're picking up the hot spots. We know where they are. It gets picked up. The mud is brought to a treatment facility, almost like a coffee press.
Right.
The water is removed, and then that solid material is shipped off to a hazardous waste disposal facility because it's really toxic. We're not going to get all of the PCBs out of the bottom of the river because of the dynamic that Joe just described, but we're going to get most of it, and we're very focused on these hot spots.
Are you convinced that you found all the hot spots? In other words, you know, 10 miles back where you did a year or two ago, what if you find some new hot spots late in the game?
Well, we can always go back, but there is testing and there's oversight and there's follow-up. We're not in there blind, and we're just not doing a part and moving on and never looking back. I don't think the people of the Hudson Valley would be satisfied with that. So this has been a very carefully planned and well-studied Superfund cleanup.
Well, I mean, planned and studied for years and years and years.
And finally in the river. Yeah,
and and then here you are. So how many seasons more are we expecting?
Probably 3 or 4.
Okay.
You know, last year, GE did a fantastic job. The goal was to remove 350 1,000 cubic yards, and GE exceeded that goal by almost double.
Wow.
Are you kids still fighting?
No, we are one big, happy cleanup family.
Yeah.
Never a crossword. I do have to give GE credit. Once they decided to do this, admittedly about a quarter century too late, but once they decided to do it, they have been very professional and very competent, and the EPA professional staff has a very good, productive working relationship with them.
One of the things that that came up earlier this season was the New York State Comptroller came out and said that he believed, Thomas DiNapoli believed, that they should expand dredging
further down
and to areas that were not originally targeted,
the canal,
into the canal,
right.
And GE said, well, they would investigate that, but they didn't feel that further dredging was necessary. Where do you all stand on that?
Well, EPA doesn't have legal authority to require navigational dredging, not to get too in the weeds on federal law, but we can require ecological, public health-driven dredging. Navigational dredging to reopen the canal, I think, is really, really important. The reason why the canal hasn't been dredged is if the New York State Canal Corporation picks up the contaminated sediment, when they put it down, it's going to be really, really expensive. So that's an issue for the state of New York, the Canal Corporation, and GE.
Now, which canal? Is this Champlain Canal?
Yes.
And it seems as though, from my understanding of it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that those parties are now working together to try to figure out whether that's the best thing.
I know the Canal Corporation really wants to get this done, and in fact, they will be at our news conference today at noon in Hudson Falls. I would leave it to them to describe the status of any discussions.
Okay. Now, can that material, if in that canal, can that travel into the river?
Oh, yeah.
So and then that becomes your problem?
Yeah.
Okay.
I know, it's sort of esoteric, but federal law doesn't allow us to direct removal if it's just for navigational purposes as opposed to public health protection. This has been a debate for years. I mean, the New York Attorney General's office years ago sued GE to get the canal dredged, and the court said it was not ripe yet because the environmental dredging hadn't started.
And the controller has said that GE deserves praise for getting in front of the problem and exploring the benefits of additional dredging. So
the controller is a wise man.
Yes. Okay. So working it well, politically doing a good job. So I
think he cares about the river, and there's some common sense to, if all the equipment is up there now, why not do it at the same time?
Right. When you go up there and you see it's a massive undertaking.
Yes.
I mean, this is not anything that is, oh, what are they doing?
I mean,
you know something's going on up there.
Right.
I mean, this is incredible. And there have been seasons where you haven't been able to do it, right? That you've had to take breaks?
Well, there was a delay. During the Bush administration, the big compromise was for EPA to do one season of dredging and then stop for 2 years and have a peer review process that went on for 2 years, very careful. And then GE had to decide whether to opt in for phase two of dredging, which was 90% of the project. At that point, I was at EPA, Lisa Jackson was at EPA. We had very, very serious and lengthy conversations with GE urging them to opt in. And that's what started 3 years ago. And once that phase of the project started, that's when we really picked up speed and started to get a lot of these cancer-causing PCBs out of the Hudson.
You mentioned the two-year peer review. Were they mainly looking at just if it was now resuspended in the water? What were they looking at?
That was the major issue, and also would this dredging project work? Yes or no? I mean, this is a historic project. Nothing quite on this scale has been done in the country. I mean, I really want to emphasize that this is pathbreaking and
right.
And a technological marvel in terms of what we've been able to get done. And people are studying this from all over the world.
And probably will be for years to come, because it's going to take a long time to fully understand the success rate and where it went right and where it went wrong and what can be done in the future to make this situation better.
Oh, yeah. And EPA is very good at looking back so we can adjust. Unfortunately, this is not the only contaminated river we have on our
right.
hands. I'm dealing with the Passaic River in New Jersey, which makes the Hudson look like a picnic. Gowanus Canal, Newtown Creek in New York City. It's sort of interesting. After 30 years of Congress passing the federal Superfund law, we're now just getting around to these often urban water bodies that are heavily contaminated with a whole suite of chemicals. Here, we're just dealing with PCBs, one company. The Passaic River that runs through Newark, 200 different chemicals, about 200 different potentially responsible companies that will have to pay for the cleanup.
We're going to take a quick break and return with EPA Regional Administrator Judith Enck and our roundtable panel. We would love for you to email us, roundtable@wamc.org. We'll continue our conversation after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from Skidmore College Master's Program, offering individualized graduate studies in a wide range of interdisciplinary fields. Masters at skidmore.edu. And One Roof Holistic Center, Saratoga Springs, New York, offering the Saratoga Stress Reduction Program, a 9-week mindfulness program, health insurance accepted. SaratogaStressReduction.com for registration.
Welcome back to the roundtable panel. I'm Joe Donahue with Ray Graff, and our guest this morning, EPA Regional Administrator Judith Enck. You are Administrator for EPA's Region 2. This is New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, yes?
Yes, and the 8 Indian nations in New York.
So this is an area that geographically makes no sense, but it is. I'm curious, and we want to get back to some of the other projects that you're working on. But if you looked at your job as a big pie, and I mean, what slice of this is dealing with the Hudson River, this dredging project, given its enormity?
Well, it's a big part of it because we're also learning in terms of other cleanups, but certainly the issues in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands are vastly different than what I'm dealing with in upstate New York. For instance, this Thursday, May 1st, is the 10-year anniversary of the military stopping bombing of the island of Vieques in Puerto Rico, a beautiful island off of the main island in Puerto Rico, which is heavily contaminated with unexploded ordnances, unexploded bombs, bullets. That's also a Superfund cleanup that I get to facilitate. So, you know, the Upper Hudson is always on my mind. You know, part of it is because of my history here. But EPA Region 2, second to none, Region 2, we have more federal Superfund sites than any other region in the country.
Well, you mentioned earlier before the break, Gowanus Canal. And, you know, it's legendary.
Yes.
Just how polluted is it, and what are you guys doing?
It's horribly polluted, and it's where hundreds of thousands of people live in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
So about 2.5 years ago, after great controversy, EPA listed the Gowanus Canal on our federal Superfund list. For some reason, the city of New York was strongly opposed. They were worried about how it would affect housing development along the canal. It is loaded with PAHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which
that's
is
easy for you to say.
Yeah, I told you that's what it was loaded with, Ray. You wouldn't listen to me.
Which is a byproduct of coal tar production and heavy metals and raw sewage. And in fact, the public comment period on cleaning up the canal just passed this past Saturday. So this is a very ambitious project. It's imperative that we do this quickly because during Hurricane Sandy, the canal breached its banks. And so I was out there the morning after Sandy hit, and people had the Gowanus Canal in their basements.
Yikes.
All over the street.
Mm.
We did some testing, found very high levels of pathogens and bacteria. So we want to get that Superfund site addressed rapidly.
So will the techniques be different given we have different things lurking in the Gowanus?
Actually, it will be similar to the Hudson. We will likely do some dredging. I'm not sure we're going to have the luxury of hot spot dredging. It may go bank to bank. Mm-hmm. This is a very active area. There are some businesses that we don't want to interrupt. It's a much shorter stretch. It's only, I think, 4 miles total. But we will take the lessons from Hudson River dredging and apply it to the Gowanus Canal for sure.
Mm. And you also have, it would seem to me in this project, some real, there's a lot at stake dollar-wise as far as, because this area has now become prime real estate. So people are looking at what effect this is having on that region and saying, okay, and I'm just curious, is that more of an impetus to do things move faster when that's on the,
nothing ever moves fast.
Well, that's a truism. Well,
I mean, because like we sit up there in Washington County and say, well, they don't care about it. You know, it's going to take forever, and it took however 30 years, and okay, whatever. And then you look at this and say, well, there's gobs of money just waiting to be spent. They just have to get their act together. Is that going to be an impetus to do it faster?
No. I mean, the law doesn't allow for that. We do these cleanups in a very deliberate way. They take too long, but we get it done right.
But even getting to that point, to the cleanup point?
Well, you know, this delay on the Hudson River was unprecedented.
Yeah.
This was a massive political lobbying campaign to block the project. We have not seen anything quite like that on the Gowanus Canal or Newtown Creek.
When you think of this as your job as an EPA administrator, balancing all of this and because you have the local people, you have the people that are downriver, you have the people who are being affected by what is happening in one given place, and put that into a national picture with a policy that goes with the other administrators and with an administration. So how is all that balanced? I mean, where do you go to for the guidance in saying, okay, so how do we as a group want to handle any given project?
Well, for the Hudson, we actually have an EPA office in Hudson Falls. We have 3 staff. We have a citizens advisory group that is not shy about telling us what they think. We talk to local elected officials. We have a wonderful partner with the state, Department of Environmental Conservation,
right.
And we try to replicate it at all of our sites. To your earlier issue, where I sort of dismissed you and said everything takes forever. Not that I'm bitter, but it does take a long time.
Well, sure.
Things go,
I wouldn't have asked the question if I wasn't bitter too.
Right. Things go better when there's a very engaged local citizenry, when people are really paying attention and pushing us and pushing the elected officials. I can't say it speeds us up, but it really makes us dig in, make sure we're very careful and listening to all sides. I've got lots of federal Superfund sites where I never hear a peep from anyone. Those actually are the ones that I personally pay a lot of attention to, because
that's
sad.
You don't.
Yeah, you don't have that accountability. You know, these are industrial areas, or people never believed they would be clean up in their lifetime. When I want to really have an exciting weekend and bring a Superfund report home with me to read, to, you know, send me into an early nap, I bring the reports on the sites that I don't hear about from the public. That's where I want to make sure we're doing a thorough job.
So to go a little bit further into my question, what stamp does the administration have on this office, on the EPA, and on you? So the president's agenda, environmentally speaking, is filtered down to you in what way?
Well, I'm just the little worker bee that gets to implement the president's priorities. And also, quite honestly, most of our guidance comes from existing laws and regulations. We hear from the White House not that often. The president has made a couple issues a real priority, like combating climate change. That's mostly dealt with in Washington. The previous EPA administrator, who was just so wonderful, Lisa Jackson, recently stepped down. The president has nominated an amazing woman from Massachusetts, Gina McCarthy, to take her place. So those are the conversations. And then when the EPA administrator wants the 10 regions to do something, that's typically the interaction. My stuff is small potatoes. The president is dealing with the EPA administrator and members of Congress and other members of his cabinet.
But when the president shows up here in the region, you're there.
Yep.
I mean, you do that because ultimately you are responsible to that administration.
Well, he appointed me.
Right.
Yes.
And that's cool.
Yeah. And she still talks to you, which is amazing, really.
I talk to Joe Donahue more than I talk to President Obama. But that is my dream, to have my picture taken with Joe.
Yeah. I have to say that when you think of, as I said at the beginning, I've known you for a long time, and you started out as an activist.
Yes.
And the people you were beating up is who you are now.
Yes.
And I'm so. Are there any times that you say to yourself, "Man, if this were 20 years ago, I'd be mad at me"?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I try not to have too many of those moments, but a lot of the issues are the same. And, you know, the president's a community organizer. It's okay to say that word. I used to be a community organizer.
Sure.
Now I'm a regulator.
But like President Obama perhaps has learned that, oh, gosh, you know, the president's job, there's more to it than I thought. Is there ever a time when you say, gosh, now I know I was arguing against them, but now I know what their mindset was in the EPA?
I mean, there have not been any shocking. It was pretty savvy,
I guess, as far as what was going on. It would depend on administration, right?
It depends on the administration. For instance, I never would have been appointed, nor would I have wanted to be at the EPA during the Bush administration. The Obama administration is pretty committed to environmental protection. Otherwise, I wouldn't be there. And the decision I make all the time is, where can I sit to have the most direct impact on protecting public health and the environment? And at this point, I had an opportunity to go to EPA. And so rather than knocking on the door on the outside, I get to sit in on really long, long meetings on the inside. There's a theme here where we very carefully try to make sure that the laws and the regulations are enforced. You know, it's a different tempo, it's a different culture, but everyone that works at EPA, I can say confidently, is there because they care about environmental protection. I think the difference is probably the pace.
Mm. And so now the activists who are out there, and correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, there's some wonderful environmental groups, but there doesn't seem to be the presence that there was even 20 years ago when you were there.
I don't think that's true. I think, there's a very vibrant environmental community in New York and New Jersey. Rob Moore just announced he's leaving Environmental Advocates. I had his job before I was at NYPIRG. Riverkeeper, Clearwater, Scenic Hudson.
And how do you work with them? How do you react to them now? Because you have to understand where they're coming from.
Yeah. I mean, I return everyone's phone calls, whether you are a large company or a grassroots environmental organization. And I listen and I learn. And you use the word balance, and that often is the case. We are very much guided by science and the law. And my question all the time is, what's best for protecting public health and the environment? But, you know, there's some room there in terms of, where do you spend your day? Where do you commit resources? And so we're looking, to have a broad conversation and also to emphasize environmental justice issues whenever we can. I'm very focused on communities that have a disproportionate burden of pollution, and they have not really had a strong enough voice in policymaking.
EPA Regional Administrator Judith Henk will be in Fort Edward at noon today, along with Eugene Leff, who is the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation Deputy Commissioner of Remediation and Materials Management, and you'll be kicking off the fourth season of dredging in the Upper Hudson River. I can't thank you enough for stopping by on your way up north, and just good to see you again, and thank you very much for keeping in touch.
My pleasure.
Should we take that picture in a moment?
Yeah, we'll take the picture.
Okay.
Yeah, excellent. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.